Tweet at Miriam O'Call.
Now I want to introduce you to Jessie Grimes. She's a clarinet player and she is the National Concert Hall's first learning and participation artist in residence. She's Dublin born, but living in the UK for a good few years now, where she's made an impact on the classical world as a soloist and an educator. Jessie Grimes, really nice to welcome you to studio today.
Hi Miriam, thanks for having me.
So lovely to meet you. Now listen, give me a bit of the background story first, your pathway into music. What's the story there?
Pathway into music. I think I was always in music even before I arrived. I think my family is a very musical family. My dad has got music. He refuses to learn to read music, but he's an incredibly musical man. He said yesterday, if we were having kind of a morbid discussion about dementia and getting very old, and he said, well, if as long as I can play a tune on the ukulele or on the whistle, I'll be grand. So, we all grew up, me and my siblings all grew up playing music. There was definitely a sort of competitive edge between us. I think when I was about six, there was a challenge. Who can learn to play the first jig on a tin whistle? And I was six, and then Clara was, four, and Frankie's two. So obviously I won.
But yeah.
So it's been from the very beginning. And then around 10, before going to secondary school, we started getting more formal education. We went to Cultus on the one hand and learnt trad. I learnt the flute. And then I changed and moonlighted as a classical musician and went to the academy and learnt the clarinet.
And why the clarinet?
I wanted to be really cool like Lisa Simpson and play the saxophone because I was obsessed with the Simpsons. And then I was too small. And in my audition, they almost kind of laughed at me because I came in, I want to play the saxophone. And they're like, you won't even be able to hold it. Yeah. So they gave me a clarinet. And actually, it's now my entire career. So I'm quite grateful for being a bit small as a kid.
We're always told there's a lot of pressure in classical music, isn't there? A fear of failure. So how well equipped were you to deal with that?
I think I was not the best equipped. I think I was quite probably sensitive to it in the way that I grew up and the kind of adapting strategies I had through various things that happened in my childhood, including the loss of my brother. I think my understanding was, if I'm good at stuff, you'll be okay and everyone will be okay. And so I think I took that into classical music, and in some ways it wasn't great for me until I kind of had to do quite a lot of work into my 30s, even in therapy, to figure out separate the perfectionism, which is so inherent in doing this thing. You've got a genius of a composer who's written something beautiful and perfect and you want to honour it and not put in the wrong notes. I'm doing air quotes for wrong notes, and learning now that actually the creativity is in the energy that you put into it. And if there's a wrong note, it doesn't actually matter.
You mentioned your brother there, James. So I hope you don't mind me asking you, would you mind telling me what happened to James?
Yeah, I'm really happy to talk. James had bipolar, or they called it manic depression back in the day, and struggled through his kind of late teens and into his early 20s, was in and out of psychiatric care. So he was my half-brother. And I think as a little kid, I didn't really know, except thinking, oh, it's good when you make him laugh. So I think there's a part of me who wants to be funny that's still connected to that. And then when he was 26 and I was 10, he took his own life. I think it just got too much. And he said, OK, that's enough for me. And it was quite an earthquake in the whole family, as something as violent and dramatic as that is. And a difficult thing maybe in Ireland in the 90s to deal with. Like, we're quite my family's quite a liberal and open family, but still, it's the 90s and we're talking about mental health and suicide. So it was a pretty tricky one to navigate and deal with. And everybody, I think this is just the way families are. Everybody holds and deals with their grief in a different way. I've been doing, as part of my work, trauma awareness training and how to work in spaces where people have experienced trauma, and learning actually that's a trauma that I experienced. And instead of quote unquote fixing it or trying to heal yourself, how do you steward and shepherd that trauma along and live with it and alongside it? I'm learning now there's a softer way to kind of live with that and know that this is a presence, and in loads of ways a gift that was given to me that's helped me shape my life.
At the time, though, now you were so young, but when you look back now, what kind of an impact do you think, A, I suppose, did it have on your parents, then B, on you?
I have a nephew who I am very close to, and he's 8 now. And actually, through the relationship I have with him as a big person, as a grown up, with him as a little person, I'm seeing and understanding even now that how close and strong that bond would have been because, you know, it's a long time ago now and you got to question your memories and things. But that has been a gift, actually, to feel that connection, that powerful. My partner was with them the other day and apparently they were playing a game and he just thought, this would be way more fun if Jesse was here. So like, and I'm sure I would have said, this would have been way more fun if James was here at loads of different points in my life. So I think it had a huge impact. And I think it's part of, in some ways, it's part of maybe where my kind of, where I've ended up with like my superpowers with humans. Like one of the things I do is hold spaces. So whether it's the National Concert Hall full of families or it's a workshop space, part of it is being able to read the room and see how everybody's doing so you can include all of the energies. And I think probably as a little one, I was just trying to do that because everyone around me was very sad.
Do you think music helped you? Because also you were going then quite soon after that into your teenage years. You had to deal with your own sexuality. So do you think music helped you explore that, deal with all of that?
Yeah. And I think that was modelled. I was chatting with my folks the other day. That was definitely modelled. I have memories of my dad lying on the sofa listening to Mahler. And like, you wouldn't go in the front room if dad's in there listening to Mahler. And that was how he was processing his grief. And I think, yeah, going into my teenage years, it was a way that I could understand my identity. Because I think as we grow, I was having a talk with young artists the other day, and one of these young people said to me, I had talked about when you really know your true self, you can then step into your art. And one of these teenagers was like, how do you know when you're your true self? And it was heartbreaking and gorgeous question. And my answer was, you're just going to keep trying on selves, like different jumpers. And then when it doesn't fit anymore, you take it off. So for me, it was trying on different music and different periods of my growing up. My teenage years were different phases of music. I can like strongly associate, I love Peter Andre, and then I loved Jim Morrison from The Doors, and then I loved Joni Mitchell, and I was very in it, and I think it was the centre of my understanding of myself and life. So I'm sure, yeah, I was expressing things that maybe were harder to express, and I taught myself the guitar, a slight rebellion from the formal classical stuff. I was in my room and I still think about the guitar in like shapes instead of understanding the notes. And I wrote songs and I sang songs, and I definitely think it was a processing thing. And then it was a centre of the family as well.
So I know you're incredibly happily settled down in Suffolk with your partner, Brogan. Where did you meet them and what do they do?
We met 10 years ago on an internet dating site. And at the time, they were running a PR company with their sister. And sure, we got on very quickly. I was maybe, let's just say, experimenting and playing the field a little bit in London, having gone through a couple of longer term relationships. And the short version is there was a very niche lesbian dating app, and I kind of tried to complete it like a computer game. And Brogan was one of the last people that came up, and we went on a date, and it was Brogan's ever first date. They'd never been on a date before, and I married them.
So, and it's worked.
Yeah. And I think through seeing how I'm an artist and a freelancer, they ended up quitting that kind of 9-to-5 job and have navigated their way through freelancing as a filmmaker. And now they're an author with a 2-book deal with Penguin. There's a big book coming out in March 2025. So we've kind of floated our way through this the last decade in listening to what feels right. And now we're nomads. We put everything in storage 18 months ago. We've lived in 3 different countries trying to decide where we want to live from it sounds a bit wishy-washy, and I can see my sister-in-law rolling her eyes a bit, from a kind of a soul place of where do I feel drawn to live next? And was it France? Was it Ireland? We can live anywhere because Brogan's a writer, and I write and then I'll fly and do my work and come back. And we've ended up on this beautiful part of East Anglia on a tidal river, and it's beautiful.
You also went to Nicaragua for a while, didn't you, both of you? And that was a really important, wasn't it, time in your lives?
It was. We had gone through the thing that a lot of people do in their mid-30s. We got married, and then we kind of were like, well, the next thing you do is have kids. And then we sort of pushed our way through that and started doing IVF. And then Brogan got really sick, and in part of doing IVF, Brogan had quite a big gender kind of dysphoria and a realization. So they changed their name, came out as non-binary, changed their pronouns, which was a big shake-up and a change for me. But Nicaragua, we went to Costa Rica and Nicaragua in Christmas time. It was one of the first Christmases we were able to travel after lockdown, and we broke all of our family's hearts by being like, yeah, we're going to go to South America. We traveled on Christmas Day, and we spent 6 weeks nomading in the way that we do now and following where we should we go next, and ended up in the middle of nowhere in a jungle, wandering around half naked with a machete, having an amazing time and being really connected with nature, swimming with dolphins and bioluminescence. And it sounds heavenly, but it was a bit scary as well, because we're right in the middle of snakes and all sorts of stuff. Eventually, after in that 6 weeks, a kind of anxiety or a need to prove something dropped and shifted. And by the end, we said, how can we live our lives more from this place of connection with nature and a sense of freedom and not obligation having to do things, but more, how can we flow in life a little bit more easily?
I know you also have an issue with your hearing, don't you?
I have a condition called otosclerosis, which is a hereditary degenerative condition. And so the bones in my middle ear are fusing and not vibrating. Currently, it's in my right ear, so I think I'm about 70% deaf there. I use a hearing aid. That's been a big journey to like find equipment that works well in music, because they're very clever machines for talking. But for music, you need a lot of work. So I think actually probably it's a hereditary thing in my family, though it wasn't diagnosed before. And I don't know. At some stage, my left ear may go at any time. That's the scary thing now. Currently, I'm functioning with one ear. So I would say I'm hearing impaired, but everything is so far so good. But as I learn and navigate this kind of new version of me who has a hearing impairment and needs help, I'm also seeing and understanding so many other people who have disabilities in all sorts of different ways. And it's a new perspective on life, I think. And, oh, I actually need a little bit of help, or I might need to consider where I sit at a dinner table. And it sounds almost trivial. Loads of people have hearing things. And actually, I think as everybody, I was at a talk with a very good audiologist, and he was saying basically by the time you get to 70, everybody should have hearing aids in the same way that we get glasses, because our hearing just goes as we get older. And they are amazing. I'm very much in the hearing aids are cool camp now, because they've changed my life in the last year.
Which is wonderful. Mm. Now, listen, tell me about the National Concert Hall role as learning and participation artist in residence. It sounds great. What is involved?
It does sound great. And I get my face right on the front of the concert hall. My folks are almost sick of seeing me now. What I love about it is that this season, for the first time, the concert hall have put learning and participation, so community connection, learning, all of that stuff, it's on the same level as the other artists. So we've got Tara Rock, we've got Bryce Dresner from the National, two like incredible artists, and then me. But what they're saying in that is that this artistry and this work of working with families, working with communities, working with the people who maybe don't go to the Friday night concert or can't afford to buy the ticket to XYZ, how do we connect with everybody? And so they're valuing it on the same level. So I'm meeting people all across the industry who are really excited about the fact that LMP, Learning and Participation, has been put on that same platform. So what does the job look like? On the outside, the biggest thing is there's 7 main stage shows. Most of them I write and then present them myself. There's one coming up, which is very exciting, on the 9th of February. We're going to do Peter and the Wolf and Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, like two of the classical music, kids' pieces of music. But we've got a very awesome shadow puppeteer, Maeve Clancy. So there's going to be shadow puppets for Peter and the Wolf. And then we're going to use cameras to really zoom in and give people a different view of the instruments for the Young Person's Guide. So that one is I'm just narrating. But I think every other show, I write the script and I program it and devise it. So it's really artistically rewarding to think what would I want to see as a young person in the audience, or how can I take this piece of music? So we have a model called Symphony Shorts, where I'll take the Friday night concert. So say a big piece like Beethoven 5 or Berlioz Symphony Fantastique, something that people would say, oh, that's too complicated for kids. And I'll take it and I'll write a show where we break it down and climb right inside it and see how amazing it is and get involved and bring it to life in a different way. So I really love that. That's that very creatively rewarding to get to write a whole show and think, how can I make this as open and as fun and as welcoming so that everybody can feel, oh, I get it. Like my uncle on mum's side's not terribly musical. He won't mind me saying that. And apparently Michael said, well, I'd actually go to more classical concerts if they were like this, when he came to one of the symphony shorts, because they're fun and they're open and you can clap when you want and you can sing and you can move around and it's just a bit of crack.
Because that's great. That's exactly what you want, to make classical music more accessible. It's not all about Dickie Bowes.
Yeah, I even don't really like using classical music. It's just orchestral music, in the same way that Ray, that amazing BAFTA winning artist, pop artist, uses orchestral backing for all of her stuff. Like, it's just a load of instruments and they sound awesome together. And I don't think they should be in a different silo. They should be in with everything else.
Well, Jessie Grimes, it's been really terrific to meet you. Best of luck with your role as Learning and Participation Artist in Residence with the National Concert Hall. And for details of all the concerts for families and for schools in February and March, including Peter and the Wolf, you can go to nch.ie. Best of luck with everything, Jessie.
Thanks
for coming in and being my guest.
Thank you.